Well, turn back if you would to Matthew chapter 2, as we look at this chapter together this morning. Here's a brief sort of introduction to the book of Matthew. Matthew is all about this being the gospel of the king. Matthew's big theme is always talking about Jesus, the king, and how in this he's going to tell us the good news. It's started right back in his very first verse, chapter 1, verse 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David. It's telling us the story of Jesus Christ, the one who's the son of David, as we mentioned, with the children. Joseph is told in chapter 1, verse 21, to call him Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. And in chapter 1, you have this appearance of the angel who comes to Joseph. Luke will tell us in his account of the angel coming to Mary as well. And Luke will tell us about the testimony of Zacharias and Elizabeth and the shepherds and Simeon and Anna, all these people who came to visit or heard about the birth of Jesus. But Matthew wants to do things a little bit differently. He doesn't bring out lots of these famous Christmas stories, as it were, parts of that account of the birth of Jesus, but he keeps it very brief, telling us about the Lord Jesus being born, chapter 2, verse 1, in Bethlehem in Judea. And he just tells us it straightforward. Now that's what happened. Jesus was born in Bethlehem. And then later on, how these wise men came to visit as well. But Matthew tells us very little about what happened that night of Jesus' birth. He tells us these things that happened sometime afterwards. And Matthew tells us this story by using geography. Odd thing to do, we might think. Well, he tells us the story of the Christ child and those things that happened to Jesus in the first couple of years of his life. And it is Matthew's geography lesson. Matthew wants to take us through by name dropping. Ever met somebody who does that? You're talking to somebody and they just keep dropping in famous or famous-ish people that they've met here and there. And you get people who do it with places. And they'll be talking to you and go, oh yes, I remember the time I was trekking through the Sahara Desert. And then, you know, before too long in the conversation, they recounted the time they visited the North Pole or, you know, went to this place or another. They place name drop, trying to show how well connected they are and how many countries they visited in the world and the like. Well, Matthew's a bit like that. He's place name dropping through this chapter, just telling us of different places that Jesus is connected to. Not to boost Matthew's ego, it's not places he's visited, but they're places Jesus has been to who show us who he is, who show us how well connected Jesus is, but in all the right way. And so Matthew shows us Jesus' connections through this chapter by looking at these four different places. And he links it to four different Old Testament prophecies. That's how Matthew is going to back up this Christmas story, by telling us about this child Jesus and the things that happened in the first year or two of his life, to show us how that backs up what's going to happen later on in the gospel, showing us who Jesus really is. It starts with a prophecy and a place and a person. And it's all to do with Bethlehem. Now, this is the easy one of Matthew's prophecies. It's a pretty straightforward Old Testament prediction. Chapter 2, verse 1, the wise men journey from the east and arrive in Jerusalem. And they arrive there and they have a quick question. Where is the king of the Jews? Where is he? They're in the wrong place. As it turns out, it's not in Jerusalem. Herod maybe doesn't know offhand. And so in verse 4, he gathers together the chief priests and the scribes and asks them the question. Where is the Christ to be born? And there's the easy answer, verse 5 and 6, that there it is. He's to be born in Bethlehem of Judea. These reply in verse 5. And then they even quote it. They know it off by heart. It's a memory verse that they've all learnt. You, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah. This verse from Micah, chapter 5. The chief priests and the scribes knew it. It was a universally accepted messianic prophecy. that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. In some ways, it was quite a tick box sort of thing. You know, if you were interviewing somebody for a job of potential Messiah, and people would come up, and there they were, going to be interviewed. Are you a suitable candidate to be a Messiah? Question one, were you born in Bethlehem? If the answer's no, then you can't be. You've got to go home. Interview over. You cannot be the Messiah if you're not born in Bethlehem. That's kind of how this prophecy worked. And so, there it is. Matthew tells us that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. No accident, it's there. It's all in this prophecy of Micah. It even comes up later in John chapter 7. I don't know if you look at it now. Some of us looked at it on a Sunday evening a while back. And how the Jews ask him, but weren't you born in Nazareth? Because everyone knows the Messiah should be born in Bethlehem. It comes up in John chapter 7. It's classic stuff. It's the obvious thing. You have to tick this box if you're going to be the Messiah. So Matthew quotes this verse from Micah. And again, we looked at the book of Micah not so long ago. Last year, or was it the year before? And in the book of Micah, he has a lot to say about leaders. There's a lot to say about the kings and the chief priests and people like that. The leaders of the nation, normally, because they weren't doing the right thing, and how what poor leaders they were, and how unfair they were and unjust they were, and so on. And in the middle of Micah's prophecy, in Micah chapter 5, Micah talks about this ruler who will come. Micah chapter 5 verse 2, that a ruler will come from Bethlehem, whose going forth are of old from everlasting. And he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. They shall abide, and he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be our peace. That's the extended version of this little cut down edition that they quote, that Micah promises there is going to be this eternal one whose origins are from everlasting, and he's going to come and he's going to shepherd his flock. He's going to be the shepherd king, not an overbearing tyrannical leader like Herod, more of him later on, but he's going to be such a different king. He's going to be the shepherd king who will care for his people like a shepherd cares for his sheep. He'll be great, even to the ends of the earth, a shepherd not just for Israel, but a shepherd for the ends of the earth, and the one who shall bring peace. That's Matthew's point, as he brings up this little verse. It's a little bit like, and the way Matthew does this, it's a little bit like a web link. Never know when you're reading a story on a particular web page, and it'll have little things, and they're underlined, or they're a different colour, because you can click there for more information. And you click there and it will take you to a new page, which will tell you a bit that was linked to it. It's a bit like that in the Bible, in Matthew. You're reading through this story and you're meant to click the web link, as it were. Click that little prophecy, go to where he says, and it'll bulk it out there what he's saying. It's a little shortcut for us to find out more. And Matthew's whole point through this is the Christmas story doesn't happen out of thin air. Sometimes we get that idea, don't we? And it is the way the New Testament starts. Matthew just launches us straight in with the angel appearing to Mary and Joseph and this baby being born. But he doesn't quite, actually, because Matthew tells us before that, he gives us this whole big list of names in chapter 1, linking things to the Old Testament. And in case we didn't get the idea in chapter 2, he will give us these prophecies from the Old Testament. This doesn't just drop out of thin air. This birth of the Lord Jesus, and everyone's left scratching their heads thinking, what on earth is happening? It all links to those promises from old. It all links to the Old Testament. This is Jesus, the Messianic King, the Shepherd who brings peace, the Eternal King who will be great and who is majestic. That is who this child is. And Matthew wants to show us that from a geography lesson. Second place he'll bring up then is Egypt. Next prophecy. Next place. Next link that Jesus has. He's linked to Egypt. So the wise men visit Herod. They're given more information that they should go to Bethlehem, which they do. and they're given strict instructions to come back and report the child's location to Herod. Then they're warned in a dream, verse 12, not to do that. They're warned to go straight back to their homes, take a different route, sneak out, as it were, so Herod does not know where they've gone or where they were. And in verse 13, when they depart, the wise men, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. He said, arise, take the young child, his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. That's what happens next. An angel comes. We're used to the angels at Christmas bringing good news. But here an angel comes with bad news. This Christmas angel comes to Joseph to tell him there's bad news. Herod wants to destroy the young child. It's no mystery to God, this secret plot to assassinate a potential rival to Herod's throne, or so he thinks. They're told exactly what to do and where to go, that they're going to go to Egypt. It wasn't left up to Joseph to use his idea of the best place. They're told. And so they fled down to Egypt. It was about 75 miles to the border, then about 100 miles to the big cities of Egypt. There were lots of Jews living there. It's possible they might have had relatives and so on. Lots of Jews over the course of the centuries in between the Testaments had fled to Egypt. Lots of the wars that had happened in the land of Israel. And so the land of Egypt was home to a very large refugee community of people from Israel. And they're told to go there. Jesus was maybe a year or two old at this point. Most people guess, sort of trying to link up some of the dates, that they were there about a year or so. We know that Herod died in the year 4 BC and so on. And then they find out in verse 15 that Herod has died. Told nothing else about their time there in Egypt. And the time has come for them to return from Egypt. And Matthew tells us that this is there to fulfill a prophecy of Hosea. Out of Egypt I called my son. There's the next little quotation for us, and he uses his word. This is happening to fulfill what the prophet said. That he would come, his son would be called out of Egypt. And in Hosea and chapter 11, verse 1, you want to click the web link, as it were, and go to that new page. In Hosea chapter 1, we find those words quoted. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. This time, though, it's not perhaps the same straightforward prophecy that we had before in Micah. Hosea is talking about God's judgment. Often he uses the analogy of a husband and wife. Through most of the book, he's comparing God's people to being like an unfaithful wife. But God still loves them. And in Hosea chapter 11, he changes the metaphor more to think about the father who loves his son, God who loves his children, Israel. And in Hosea chapter 11, he talks about out of Egypt I called my son, and how he brought the Israelites out of Egypt. His love for them and how he cared for them. The obvious thing in Hosea chapter 11 is that God is talking about the nation of Israel and what he did do when he brought them out at the time of the Exodus. And yet Matthew says this is fulfilled by Jesus. A little bit of a funny sort of thing. It's not quite the obvious one that Micah was. Matthew is making a parallel in those. He sees there a parallel. In Hosea chapter 11, God is talking about bringing his people out of Egypt. And Matthew says, oh, look, there's a parallel there between what happened to Israel and what happened to Jesus. It wasn't like the other thing from Bethlehem, where everyone was expecting that to happen. No one was really looking at Hosea thinking, oh, Jesus must go to Egypt next. But with the benefit more of hindsight, Matthew can sort of trace the dots and say, hang on a minute, look, there's something else going on here. Jesus survives the slaughter of the male children. And that sounds awfully like Moses in the Old Testament, who survived a very similar attempt to kill the male babies there in Egypt. And Moses and the Israelites were called out of Egypt. The Exodus in the Old Testament is God's big project his great saving work that he did in the Old Testament. And they keep coming back to it and referring everything to it. And so Moses and the Israelites were rescued out of Egypt and brought to God's promised land. That's the same sort of thing that Jesus does. He's brought back out of Egypt. He goes back to the promised land of God's people. Matthew's going to bring out more of it. Matthew chapter 3, he's going to have Jesus going through the water. A bit like the Israelites going through the Red Sea, Jesus is going to be baptized in the water. End of Matthew chapter 3, Jesus is going to go out into the wilderness, like the Israelites did on their journey. He's going to be there 40 days, which is kind of like their 40 years. Matthew's going to construct this parallel to show us that Jesus is kind of tracking through the same kind of path they were. A rewrite, if you like, of something. He's a bit like Moses. He's a bit like Israel. And kind of we're meant to watch and wait in Matthew. What's going to happen next? We know the old story of Moses and the Israelites and how they were called out of Egypt, how God loved his son. God loved the nation of Israel. And yet in Hosea 11, I taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms, but they didn't know I healed them. I drew them with gentle cords. I drew them with bands of love. I was as those who stooped to take the yoke from their neck. I called to them, but they went from me. They sacrificed to the Baals and burnt incense to idols. That's the story in Hosea. I loved my people. I loved my son, says God, the nation of Israel. But he walked away from me. That's the Old Testament story. And as the pages of Matthew open before us, we're meant to be on the edge of our seats thinking, hang on a minute, this sounds awfully familiar. It sounds like Moses. It sounds like the Israelites. But is it going to happen any better? Is Jesus going to fall for the same mistakes that they did? Out of Egypt, I called my son. Someone like Moses, the great prophet, prophesied in Deuteronomy. One like Moses who would come. A beloved son who would come. That special one connected to his father. And so we watch and wait as Jesus heads out into the wilderness for 40 days. What's going to happen? Is he going to doubt? Is he going to not trust God anymore? Is he going to betray his father? Is he going to turn his back? Is he going to go his own way? We watch and wait, as Matthew will tell us the rest of the story. But here he tells us of this fulfillment, that Jesus is the Son. He's the obedient Son. That's what's going to come up in the Gospels. He's the Son who's called out of Egypt, and yet he's so much better than Moses, so much better than the nation of Israel, for he's going to be God's beloved Son who carries on following his Father every step of the way. Third place then, a prophecy and a place and a person, Jesus, who's linked to Ramah. Next place that Matthew has for us, a next quotation. Verse 16, Herod, when he saw this, he was deceived by the wise men. He was exceedingly angry and sent forth his soldiers, we think, and put to death all the male children in Bethlehem and its district, 2 years old and under, according to the time he determined from the wise men. So Matthew tells us what happened next, that Herod was so angry that he sought to do whatever he could to get rid of this potential rival by killing the baby boys of Bethlehem. And Matthew tells us, the second time he uses his word, this was to fulfill what was spoken by Jeremiah, the prophet. And he'll give us another quote, verse 18. A voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. And it's a quote from Jeremiah 31, if you want to click the web link. And there in this chapter of a very famous prophecy, there it was that it was foretold, Matthew says. And it's kind of appropriate for Jeremiah to have this quote. Often we call Jeremiah the weeping prophet. In his book, he's often crying. He's the prophet who lives through the captivity. He's the prophet who sees Jerusalem come crashing down. He's the one who sees the enemies come and take people away. He's the prophet who weeps. He's the weeping prophet. And in Jeremiah chapter 31 and verse 15, he pictures somebody else weeping. He pictures the weeping that's happening in Ramah. This lamentation, this crying that happens in that place. Again, in the first instance, this isn't an obvious messianic prophecy. He pictures weeping in this place called Ramah. Ramah is about sort of 10, 20 miles north of Jerusalem, kind of the same distance that Bethlehem was to the south, with Jerusalem there in the middle. And Jeremiah thinks in his chapter 31 of the weeping that happens in Ramah. When the north part of Israel fell, a long time before, leaving only Judea and Benjamin in the south, that became the new border. Ramah became a border town between Judah and the rest, Assyria, later on Babylon, and so on. Ramah was the border town. And after the invasion, after the siege of Jerusalem, and as the exiles were taken away, they were assembled, if you like, in temporary prison camps in Ramah. That was the border. All the prisoners of war were brought there, and then they were taken away into Babylon. All the exiles went through Ramah on the way out to head off to Babylon as prisoners of war. And Jeremiah thinks of the weeping that happened in Ramah. Perhaps there were the mothers who watched their soldiers who'd been captured, taken off as prisoners of war. Yeah, the tearful scenes you see, like in some of the World War One and Two pictures of wives and mothers and girlfriends and like waving farewell to soldiers going off to war, weeping more when they receive the news that they're not returning, that they've been captured. When the invasion came, when the sieges came of Jerusalem, when the prisoners were taken away, there was weeping in Ramah. And Matthew says, well, now history's repeating itself. He quotes this verse and says, that's what's happening in Bethlehem. And we might say, hang on a minute, you're pulling a little bit of a fast one there because you're talking about two different places. Ramah's in one place, Bethlehem's in a different place. But Matthew says, no, it's history on the same sort of track as before. Another judgment of God. Another sadness that affects so many people. Another time of weeping. But this time it happens in Bethlehem. But there is one other link, you see. The other link is Rachel in the verse. A voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. And she's perhaps the link. Why Matthew can take a verse about Ramah and say, actually, that kind of applies to Bethlehem too. Because Rachel was the quintessential mum of the Old Testament. Think of Jacob and his 12 sons. He's the father of Israel. And the favourite wife, the favourite mother was Rachel. She's the mother of Israel, even though she only bore two of the sons. But she's the mother. And she's the classic weeper in the Old Testament. She's the favourite wife of Jacob, the mother of Joseph and Benjamin, who dies in childbirth, who literally dies weeping for her child that she's just had. And she's buried. Interesting, if you read Genesis, I think it's chapter 35, but I didn't write that down. She's buried near Bethlehem. Bethlehem was the tomb of Rachel, the weeper, the mother who died weeping. And so Matthew can link these things together and say, this is fulfilled as another tragedy strikes. As this happens in Bethlehem, it's like Rachel weeping all over again. It's like Ramah weeping. Jesus is linked to those things. And we see in those verses an attack by Satan. In verse 16, it tells us, when Herod saw he was deceived by the wise men, he was exceedingly angry. And the word it uses there is kind of that Herod was consumed by rage. That Herod was completely overcome, as it were. that he was beside himself. He was so livid with what had happened. His clever scheme to find out Jesus' location, to just eliminate him when he finds out that's not going to work. He just goes nuclear, we might say. He just goes ballistic. And it's kind of a sense that Herod is taken over by Satan. That doesn't mean that Herod's not responsible for his actions. But Herod is used, isn't he, in a satanic attack. Jesus is the devil's target. Herod is the one who's going to carry it out on Satan's behalf. And that's what we see here in Matthew chapter 2. Jesus is the devil's target. That when the Son of God comes into this world, out of Egypt I call my son, says God, he's my beloved son. And Satan will do anything he can to eliminate him, to stop him going through with God's plan of salvation, that Satan has some vague idea, perhaps, of God doing, even though he seems surprised, as we know, by what happens in it. But Satan is going to do whatever he can. And you just have to wait and see. This is just the first attempt by Satan to knock Jesus off course, to take Jesus out of the picture as the saviour of the world who will save his people from Satan and from their sins. You just have to watch, because Satan's not finished yet. You just have to weep, because it's still not over either. Jesus is the devil's target. And lastly then, one last place, one more prophecy, and one more link that Jesus has to the town of Nazareth. So Herod dies, we're told matter-of-factly in verse 19, and an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph again in a dream. Next Christmas angel, it may well be 2 or 3 years after Christmas by now. Another angel appears to Joseph in a dream and says, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the young child's life are dead." He arose, took the young child and his mother and came to the land of Israel. Herod had died. Herod had lived out, it seems, right at the end. This happened at the end of his life. His killing of these boys in Bethlehem, his attempt to kill Jesus. It seems that he didn't live much longer after that, before he died himself. And an angel appears, "You can go back to Israel," God tells Joseph. And yet it seems then they're on their way, verse 21. Verse 22, "When he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea instead of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there, and being warned by God in a dream, he turned aside to the region of Galilee, and he came and dwelt in the city of Nazareth." So they leave Egypt, it seems like they're almost en route, and they hear actually now Herod has died, the kingdom got split up. Archelaus, one of his sons, was now reigning in Judea, and he was a chip off the old block. He was a frightening tyrant, just like his father. So perhaps Joseph's initial thought to go back to Bethlehem is suddenly not a good idea. It seems he's warned again in a dream, end of verse 22. He has another warning about this situation. And so instead he turns up north and heads to Nazareth. Matthew hasn't mentioned this before. Luke has told us that the angel appeared to Mary in Nazareth. But here Matthew wants to bring it out now because he's on this geography lesson. They turned aside and went to the city of Nazareth in the region of Galilee, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, "He shall be called a Nazarene." And the funny thing is, no prophet ever said it. "He shall be called a Nazarene," Matthew says. Maybe Matthew is deliberately being a bit vague. The other times he talked about a prophet, previous time he told us Jeremiah exactly. Here in verse 23, he just says it's spoken by the prophets, plural. Keeps it a little vague. Because it's not there. It's not there in the Old Testament, this phrase that he has. It's one of those slightly more cryptic ones, perhaps. Matthew's drawing out these teachings from the Old Testament. The one about Micah, the one given by Micah, that Jesus would be born in Bethlehem, that was obvious. That's a classic prediction. Next one that Hosea said about going to Egypt, and the one that Jeremiah said about there being weeping, those are parallels. He's drawing out a historical idea and bringing it up to date and saying there's a parallel here in the life of Jesus. And this one is more an allusion, we might say, that you're alluding to something that's there in the Old Testament. You see, Nazareth means shoot, a word of hope, a little bit like the word that's used in Isaiah 11 and verse 1. It's not a precise quote that Matthew's giving, more just a sort of an idea he's bringing out. So Isaiah 11 verse 1, there shall come forth a shoot from the stem of Jesse, a branch shall grow out of his roots. And it seems that that was the place name for Nazareth. It took a Hebrew word and changed it slightly to make it into a place name. It was the place of the shoot, a shoot that comes up from the stump of Jesse. Kind of quote from Isaiah and things like that. Talking of a hope that there was. But you don't have to go far into the New Testament to realise that people use this place name as a name of derision. Perhaps it's a little bit like the way we use the same word sprout. You know, you talk about a sprout that comes up, a sprout that starts to grow. Well, sprout is also a nickname for somebody who's quite short, isn't it? You know, how we can use the same kind of word for that. Or stump. You might use the same sort of word, a shoot that's come out of the stump of Jesse. Well, that's a hopeful reference, isn't it, from the Bible? But to refer to somebody as stumpy is a sort of quite an abusive sort of nickname, isn't it? And people seem to do the same sort of thing with Nazareth. That Nazareth was named this because of hope. Hope that a shoot would come from the stump of Jesse. And yet it became this little nickname for this poor, impoverished little place that had no hope at all, really. And that's the way it came to be used. And there's tons about that in the Old Testament as well, isn't there? How the Lord Jesus would be the one who'd be despised. The one who people would look at and say, oh, that's no hope at all. That's useless. That's ridiculous, what Jesus is doing. And that's, again, a big idea there in the Old Testament that Matthew might be implying. Like Isaiah 53, verse 3, he's despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. We hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Or one last reference, Psalm 22 and verse 6. I'm a worm and no man, a reproach of men, despised by my people. Those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip, they shake their heads. Matthew's, when he says he'll be called a Nazarene, he's not quoting anything. He's not even really drawing a parallel with anything. But he's picking out this same idea that's there in all the prophets, plural, he can say. Those sort of themes, that Jesus is the despised hope. He is the shoot that's come from the root of Jesse. He is the one who's going to fulfill all those things. Matthew told us in chapter 1 of his heritage, all the way back to David and Jesse and the like. But he's the hope in Nazareth, who's despised too. And so as time goes on in the Gospels, everyone keeps mentioning Jesus of Nazareth. That's what they put on the cross, Jesus of Nazareth. It was a way of laughing. It was a way of despising, still in the times that followed, still to this day, even in Muslim countries. Followers of Jesus are called the followers of the Nazarene. It is used as a title of disdain and derision. But Matthew says Jesus is fulfilling that. He's fulfilling the fact that he is this hope, and at the same time he's despised all the way. Matthew takes us through his geography lesson. Four prophecies he has, four different places that Jesus is connected to. All of this to show this isn't just out of thin air, this new story of Jesus being born. No, no. It all links to those places of before. It links to Bethlehem and Egypt and Ramah and Nazareth. It links to prophecies in Micah and Hosea and Jeremiah and just general ones too. Who is this child there in the manger? Who is this child who escapes to Egypt? It points to who Jesus is. He's the messianic king. He's the obedient son. He's the devil's target. And he's the despised hope. Have you discovered the truth about Jesus this Christmas? There's so much more to him. Not just a baby in a manger. He's the one who makes all of these things come true. He's the King, the beloved Son of God. He's the one who fights the devil and overcomes. He's the one who wins. He's the one who rises again. He's the one who's the hope of the world. And yet at the same time, despised by him. So which one is it for you? Still despising these funny old stories from the Bible? Still not trusting in the Lord Jesus? Or coming to love this one? And that's who we follow. That's who we follow. And as we approach a new year, all of these events that happen in the first couple of years of Jesus' life, he understands weeping. His early life was marred by tragedy. He was familiar with sorrows, we're told. He's the one who's despised. And yet he is the hope. He is the victorious, obedient Son. He is the everlasting, reigning Shepherd King that we follow. Let's close and sing our last hymn. It's number 226. Who is he in yonder stall at whose feet the shepherd falls?